Australian True Crime. The live show is coming.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. HelloFresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is a true crime podcast, as the title suggests, so please consider this your warning that it's not suitable for children, and it probably will contain content that may be triggering to some people. Also, it's an Australian true crime podcast, so Australian Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander listeners should be aware it may contain the voices of deceased people.
The producers of this podcast recognise the traditional owners of the land on which it's recorded. They pay respect to the Aboriginal elders past, present and those emerging.
Australian police have issued a global warrant for the arrest of Simon Davies. The leading security and data protection guru is accused of sexually assaulting multiple children during the 1980s and 1990s when he ran a refuge for homeless children in the inner city suburb of Darlinghurst. News Corp Australia has revealed today that New South Wales Police has been working on this case for the last 8 years, alleging that Mr. Davies is a serial pedophile. His warrant lists 18 child sexual assault and indecent assault offences related to four boys over a six-year period from 1981 to 1987, but it's believed he could have assaulted many more children. The Attorney General Department is working with the Federal Police to detain the now 63-year-old. It's understood he's fled the country, though, and he could possibly be in Britain or Europe. That's prompted Interpol to issue a worldwide red notice.
In episode 342 of Australian True Crime, we met a man called Glenn, who told us about the abuse he suffered in a so-called youth refuge in King's Cross in the 1980s. The place in question was called the Homeless Children Association Refuge, and it was run by one Simon Davies, who was convicted of historical child sex offences against two boys in 2022. And one of those boys was Glenn. After that episode was published, we were contacted by a woman named Marie, who said she had more information about that story that she wanted to share. And Marie is our guest today. We begin by finding out about Marie's early life. As you'll hear, she comes from a very different background to the boys who ended up at the Homeless Children's Association refuge.
I was living in Waitara at the time, which is a very leafy North Shore suburbs. My parents got divorced when I was like 3 or 4. So I didn't really know my dad. He was in the Navy. And I think because my mother was very definitely not into my dad at all, she was very negative about him. You know, it was quite terrible, actually. So there was me and my twin brother. She had some sort of form of like narcissism, or there was a lot of anger with my mum. She would just spew a lot of vitriol about my dad. So we definitely had nothing to do with him. So if he sent presents, like when he was overseas doing his Navy stuff, she'd hide those presents. But my mother was very, like, I remember when I was 5 and I was saying, oh, I'd really like to be like you, Mum. And she was just like, you never want to say that. You never want to be like me. And like, this is her screaming at me on the street. Just, I'm 5. And I remember, I've got another memory of her when I lost my hat in the playground and she's yelling at me and saying how, you know, I'm embarrassing her. And that was kind of just how she spoke to both of us. Now, my brother got it a bit worse because she went through this. I'm a feminist, so I'm not saying anything, but at the time she thought she was a feminist and she was very like anti-man. So my poor brother got it as a child. So it was pretty full on. She was a very complex woman. I don't know how my dad and her really got married. He's very working class, very farm person, Navy. She was very much like an intellectual, very good artist, good writer. She did a lot of acting. I think she did some acting with Lorraine Bailey. I remember meeting lots of actors. So there were good sides to my mum, but she definitely did not enjoy being a mother. So it was hard for me because I used to faint a lot. I cried a lot. You know how the goats faint when they're like in shock? Yeah, I used to like do that all the time as a kid. I was under a lot of stress.
I'm imagining she wasn't overly sympathetic when you fainted and things.
No. I remember I got lost in Girlston Park, and when I got out and they finally found me. And she was so angry with me and how I had embarrassed her. So I think she has, like, I don't want to diagnose her, but I guess I've gone through my own mental health sort of journey. And I do suspect narcissism, and also I do have a sort of minor borderline personality disorder, because I could see it in myself when I got older and I was like, okay, yeah, I can definitely see that. But I'm not like, I'm the most empathetic person. I'm the actual opposite.
It tends to work that way.
Yeah. Yeah. She used to like tell us, look, when you're 14, you can leave because legally I don't have to look after you. And she would talk a lot about that.
14?
Yes.
Okay.
But I was like 6 or 7 or 8. She would always talk about that. That was a narrative. So she already had in her head that we were leaving. So I was living under the threat of homelessness from a very young age. And then my stepfather comes in.
And what sort of energy did he bring in? Was that a positive change?
No, he is like very meek kind of person. Like, I guess just a very, I guess geeky. But no, when he came in, our lifestyle changed. We moved to a bigger house in Waitara, and he was a teacher. So his job, he taught at...
Are they flash schools? I'm not from Sydney. So what sort of schools are they?
Private. So it's like Toorak.
Okay.
Or what's the Queensland? Auchenflower. Actually, it's a lot of the schools where the Royal Commission into Child Abuse found a lot of predators. I couldn't get any recourse through the Royal Commission for Child Abuse because the abuse happened in my bedroom. So I did try that. But also he was casual. So he would work. He was just more like a contractor. And unfortunately, I mean, I gave you a bit of a picture of my mother. So he obviously picked her because he wouldn't sleep with his students because they're all from wealthy areas. So I was an ideal victim because it was obviously a very stressful house. It's very chaotic. Also, she was very isolating. She wouldn't let us stay at friends' places or have friends. So he just made a beeline for her. Now, I can't speak for my brother and I won't, but I definitely experienced sexual abuse from him from the ages of 8 until 10. And then I did get to leave because I had to go and live with my dad in Brisbane. I think it was 11 to like 13. But when I came back, because he had to go, my dad had to go back on whatever, what's it called when they're in the Navy and they go off and...
Deployment?
Yeah, they're off. And then he tried, even as a teenager, he would, like, he'd take me out to the Cross to jazz clubs and say, wouldn't you prefer to have me as your boyfriend? And, you know, so this is a well-known person in the community. And, yeah, the abuse was, I think, from 8 to 10, and I've got a lot of memories of it. It's not like something that ever leaves me, you know, and I think he's doing actually all right. I mean, he's still employed with the Department of Education.
So he wasn't named in the Royal Commission. He's never had a conviction for child sexual assault.
No. I tried. There just wasn't enough proof, and my mother refused to participate. So the reason I got kicked out, it was around the time, so it was 1984, so I was in year nine, and my mum had broken up with him. So I had moved back to live with her.
So when you came back and you're 13, you're nearing the threshold. Did she hold true to it? Was she still saying?
Well, she did it using the fact that I told her about my stepfather, and she was leaving him, and she asked me, why don't you like him? What is it? And I told her, and then she confronted him and made it really dramatic, as was my mother's wont, with this knife. And he's going, well, I just patted her on the bum, you know, and she liked playing with her brush, you know, with her hair, you know, this kind of crap. And then she went and told everyone at the pub with her new boyfriend. So I was like, rolling my eyes, because I was still a teenager. All this stuff's going on. But it's 1984. I'm really into Susie and the Banshees and the Damned. And I've got all my posters on the wall, because in those days you got the magazines from the UK. And yeah, I was really into my pop culture and watching The Hunger with David Bowie and Susan Sarandon. And I had a good group of mates. Hornsby Girls High was good for that. I was doing really well at school as well.
Yeah, you're obviously a really intelligent person. So when you talk about the pop culture that you were into, you were into that really heightened artistic, and I'm probably biased because I was into the same stuff. So I'm thinking, yeah, I get it. You're a really smart, sassy young woman. You've been forced to grow up quickly because of your life. You know, you're, what's that word people use now? Parentalizing or something, about when kids have to parent their parents because their parents are loose idiots. Mm. So as all of that's happening, you are a very sophisticated young woman at 14. It's not fair the way you've become that, but you are.
And then I wrote a story, and Mrs. she just put me in the office and said it was inappropriate. They would have known who I was writing about because he was part of their school community.
So you disclosed in a story.
Yeah.
And they punished you.
Yeah. And then my mum is like, okay, would you like to leave school? I mean, yeah, I'm 14. Of course I'd like to leave school.
Yeah, it's our jobs as mothers to say, no, you're not leaving school. Because everyone wants to leave school at 14. Yeah. It's our jobs to, you know, convince people not to leave school at 14.
I mean, this time I'm sort of escaping out of the window and hopping on the train. Like, I'm right opposite going to the Exchange, which is this, was the hotel at the time on Oxford Street in Sydney. So I'm off. I'm out of here. But anyway, so in the end, that's how I ended up on the streets of Oxford Street at 14.
You know, and who could blame you? You know, now, since 10 minutes ago when I first asked this question, now I'm thinking, well, how can anyone blame you? Of course you left home at 14. So where did you go to first? Where did you land? You got to try and find somewhere to live.
I wasn't even thinking that. I had a bag with all my posters and my three favourite dresses. And I mean, I had this like red, I dyed my hair bright red and I'd cut it and I'd shaved it down the side. So I just put all my stuff at Central Station. In those days they had lockers, and I just went out and partied my head off. And then I'd meet a lot of gay men who were like, would you like to stay with us? And that's how I survived.
Because there were so many children, we're learning now, so many children around Central Station and around the Cross.
Yeah.
Just like sitting ducks, literally sitting ducks, sitting on those stone walls, sitting on the picnic benches, just sitting around.
Yes.
Waiting for adults to come by, whether they be good or bad people, and make you offers. That was the go, wasn't it?
Absolutely. And sex work was very different to what it is now. So in Sydney, So with Oxford Street, then you've got the wall, which is the street that goes down to Darlinghurst and King's Cross. And so I met a lot of sex workers, which was great. I love sex workers. I really love them to death. I just have a real soft spot. But they, one guy, and these were young men and women, but mostly young men at the time, because it was a gay precinct. I mean, look, it was Oxford Street is not, in 1984, is not the Oxford Street it is now.
No.
But that was my world, and I liked it. And then you mix all the drug dealers and the, and then you deal with the pimps and the, now I wasn't part of that. I was, my way of dressing, look, I was overweight. I was like 80 kilos. And I think that was good. I was overweight, to be honest. Well, I thought I was overweight at the time, but I wasn't fragile. You know, I wasn't like some of the girls look like you could just, you know, like you break them in two. I wasn't like that.
Pick them up and carry them away,
yeah.
Which people did sometimes.
It's sort of good that I wasn't like that.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I hear.
And I also fought back all the time. I had a mouth. One of the guys there said, well, why don't you get into, you know, sex work? And I'm like, oh, no, I'm 14. I'm going to uni. That's what I'm doing. And I didn't mean it in a judgmental way, but I was just very matter of fact about it. And then I ended up in a home which is just near Paddington Markets. I think I must have been looking for money. I mean, I must have been going to social services. I think I got young and homeless. It's like $70 a week or something. So.
Is that like a, yeah, right, like a pension, like a dole or something for kids? Yeah.
I must have. I think I did do that. But, yeah, my first thing to do, and it's probably my first thing to do now, is to go and dance with gay people.
Grace. Hey, me too. God, you and I get all of that. So then when did you cross paths with this group of people, Simon Davies and his cohorts?
That was interesting because when I didn't meet him until 1987, 88. So I'd been, and I had not gone back home and I'd been living pretty much on my own for that period. Like, I mean, I started renting in 1986. I basically, that was it with both my parents.
Wow.
And I haven't seen my mother since 1991. So
you were pretty street smart, I would say, by the time you ran into this character.
Yes, I was. So I was 18 at this time. And I was at Ramley TAFE because I was doing my HSC because, remember, I had decided I was getting an education. But housing was an issue. I was always moving. Obviously, I had terrible interpersonal skills. I obviously wasn't getting any support I needed. So Simon Davies' sister, youngest sister, we were really good mates and we were very similar and she liked to party and she was fun. We used to go to rap parties together. She's great, like an amazing human being, very smart as well. I think I was renting with someone I didn't like and she said, oh, well, come and stay with me. And that is, then I walk into this house. He's living in Burwood, which is near Strathfield. At that time, that's where a lot of the private schools were as well. It's very leafy. Simon was there. I think he had another place where he had the boys, but he moved.
Yeah, I'm starting to wonder if this was his parents' house.
Well, his dad, because his mother had died.
That's right. So now, timeline-wise, he lost the refuge somehow and he moved back to his family home. But when I say somehow, because I remember when we spoke to Glenn, the court still placed him with Simon as his legal guardian after to go and live in this house with his family after the refuge was no more. So he wasn't in trouble for his dealings with children.
No. Well, I mean, I think it sounds like I'm not really into conspiracy theories or anything like that, but I definitely have met a lot of pedophiles.
Okay. That's quite a sentence.
Yeah.
Go on.
I have met many of them. And it's not a conspiracy the way that they work. Like, it's just this weird, it's like going into an organization that's toxic. It's a culture that enables this behavior.
This is how our previous guest, Glenn, described his experience in episode 342 of Australian True Crime.
The whole time I'm there, that's where I really went through a lot of abuse. Four of those five men abused me. The first time I was abused was by Simon. He got me drunk one night. He used to let me sit in the office playing guitar, drinking, and another pedophile named Paul Jones turns up and gives me a tablet called Mandrakes. I wake up in the morning and I'm naked in his bed. I got out of bed. I got dressed really quickly. I was so embarrassed. I was so angry. And I remember running downstairs. And as I came out the door, I said to Grant Morris, I'd seen Grant first. I said, Simon raped me last night. And he looked at me horrified and he said, what? He said, oh, Glenn, can we, don't tell anyone, he said, I'll meet you tonight at this cafe and we'll have a talk about it. Then that night I go and I meet Grant Morris and he's with another woman that worked at the refuge. She's a sexual assault counsellor named Annie Crow. And she sits me down and she says to me, Glenn, you're overreacting. She said, Simon loves you. And then Grant turns around and says, this is how King's Cross works. She said, don't you understand? He said, every one of us has a boy and every boy has a guy that looks after him. This is normal. By the time it's finished, they've talked me out of doing something about it and into believing that someone loves me, you know, someone cares about me. I've got a girlfriend, but in my head now I'm fucking confused.
Even as you're talking about your stepfather, the teacher, who's still working, by the way, taking you to jazz clubs as a young teenager on some dates, you know, in inverted commas, and I'm thinking, God, there's just so many children in King's Cross at that time, obvious children, around adults everywhere, you know, including police, including all kinds of adults. And so it does feel like a conspiracy of silence at the very least, where people, everyone's turning a blind eye to this activity that's happening. And we all knew and we all know still that King's Cross was this neighbourhood in Australia. It was the blue light district, but we didn't know that children were being raped. I don't think we did. I don't think we accepted that as a culture. But it feels like a lot of people did.
But not just the Cross. I mean, where I came from, it's the leafy, like it's
you're right.
When I did try to get justice for me with the teacher, the police said, it's everywhere. We're inundated with cases. And also it's intergenerational with me as well on both sides of my family. And I even have a cousin on my dad's side who went to jail. And I've been abused by my dad as well. And I would be told, well, that's just men. My aunt would say, that's just men. Men have needs. You're being a drama queen.
And even as I went to Catholic schools and they were ever sort of really telling us that men are helpless against their needs.
That's right.
You know, all this slut shaming is really about that, isn't it? It's about saying, look, men are helpless. Men are hopeless. That's all this about, you know, what you're wearing and don't drink too much and how it's our responsibility is because behind that is this idea that men are just these lustful animals who can't control themselves and so we can't blame them for their actions.
Yeah, I think the whole thing with the Cross and Oxford Street, because it wasn't just the Cross, it was Oxford Street, it's the whole Darlinghurst area. There were a lot of squats at that time too, so I guess a lot of us went there because you could squat in those days on Liverpool Street and around where the refuge was and Stanley Street, all that area. So anyway, going back to Simon's.
Well, you make the point that when you met him, he wasn't in the Cross. So I just want to make that again, reiterate the point that you made.
Yeah.
Which is he wasn't in the Cross. He was in a beautiful leafy suburb.
Yep. Yeah. So he had a few reasons to be there. Now, it was a brick house. The mother had died and he was living with his two young, much, much younger sisters. I think his younger sister, who was my friend, was my age, 18. He must have been like 30.
Yeah. He was definitely an adult, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And then his other sister was only like 20.
How did you feel about being in the home? Were you happy to be back in the leafy suburbs and with a roof over your head?
Yeah, I was. And also I guess because the sisters were more my age. But then I noticed there were boys there. But there were two classes of boys. So first, the boys living there, one was Simon's, and I'm saying this is on a podcast, but I'm doing this thing with my fingers, abbreviating. He's a boyfriend who was younger than me. So I think at the time, 15, and another boy. So people Google Simon Davies because you can get a visual. He's quite repulsive. Sorry. He is repulsive.
He is repulsive in every way. Go ahead.
And then I remember walking past and the door was open and he's in the middle and I saw them. So I saw Simon. Now, these boys were beautiful. I guess that's why it's like these boys were beautiful, tan skin, beautiful young men. And they're both in bed. Like he's like the sausage in the middle of this horrible pedophile sandwich. Sorry. I have a sense of humour. I'm very dark.
No, you do. But also I get this. The thing that happens in this situation is you are talking now and I can feel that you're seeing it as a teenage girl sees it and you're expressing it as a teenage girl expresses it, you know, because in that moment you are wondering, what the fuck? Look, why are these beautiful young boys with this gross old guy? Like, what is going on? It doesn't make sense to me. That's just weird. It just doesn't make sense. And it's gross. He's gross. And it's funny, I think, when we think back to really powerful memories like that, we do often express them in the way we expressed them at the time, even thought them at the time. So I understand what you're saying. You know, at the time, you just kind of, when you're a teenager, this is the way it comes up. It's natural to think of this, especially when it's a really disturbing memory.
It was disturbing. I mean, I do remember, I did feel disassociated. You know, that happens to a lot of survivors. I definitely disassociated and left I was almost like vicariously quite traumatized. I still am to this day. And I felt sick. But in those, I wasn't thinking that at any of this time that I knew that what was going on was wrong. But every time I mentioned it, adults were saying, this is inappropriate, you're a drama queen, you're too sensitive. And no one was talking about anything. And so then I got to get quite close. His boyfriend, he became quite close to me, I think got a little crush on me. I was like, yeah, you're a kid. You know, I mean, 18, 15. But he'd say, I'm not gay. I'm not gay. This is so confusing. And it broke my heart. It really broke my heart. And anyway, so then another big part of this whole household, Simon made money from tutoring rich young teenagers. So you'd have this household where these working class homeless kids lived. He made money from them. I think he made money as a carer. I think I remember his sister telling me that. And I think he made money from looking after his sister too until they turned 18. And then these boys would turn up with their little boater hats and their uniforms and have these political arguments and debates. And Simon would be the, you know, everyone would be just, he's like most pedophiles, very charming. Not all pedophiles, but this kind of pedophile, the one I've met a lot of, the educated one. And everybody's like revolving around him, like love the sound of his own voice. And interesting, and I do want to add this, my image of this is you've got all the private school boys beautifully dressed and then the homeless kids, you know those short shorts that young men wore in the 70s, 80s?
I do, like those little stubbies or, but I know yeah. Really cheap cotton shorts, yeah.
That's all they had on, no top.
Wow.
Yeah, it was really creepy. That always bothered me. There was this whole class thing in that house, the whole classism of it, and that really pissed me off.
I can't imagine how that felt as a young man, a teenager, who's already lived through whatever at home, probably violence, alcoholism and all that, been through a couple of maybe foster homes, and then to find yourself sitting on a couch in this nice suburban house in these little shorts and nothing else, while these guys come through in their blazers and boater hats and their flash school clothes and you're all just sitting around in the same lounge room, I can't imagine what that would feel like and how that would still feel 40 years later.
I did wonder if there was anything untoward that had happened with the private school boys. But I'm like, well, now I doubt it. You know, yeah, Simon would have to be pretty stupid. I think these boys, their parents were high up and quite wealthy. I don't know. I'm not saying that someone who's in a private school, a lot of private school children get abused, but I'm talking about this particular setup within this household. Yeah, he needs these wealthy people. Because remember, I'm only seeing a slice of it through my eyes as a street, someone who had been on the streets, who's going, hey, wait a minute, what's going on? Who'd been abused, you know, a lot. But then I'm also drinking and smoking myself and I'm a hot mess. And then we'd have these parties. He'd hold these parties and he'd wear this little boater hat, like Bride's Head Revisited. And so there'd be all his friends and they were like intellectuals, judges, journalists, and all the grown men. And then the private school boys, and then us TAFE kids, TAFE people, all different ages, just artistic, I don't know, the queer kids and stuff. Like
the colour.
The colour and just all drinking, smoking. Oh, there was so much grass and like so much marijuana, you know, and hash. And these are kids. So that was what he would do with these boys. He would, yeah, they were always drunk. They were always out of it. He's meant to be looking after them. They've come from alcoholic families. And
again, here are adults coming to parties at his house and you're alleging they're members of the judiciary, they are journalists, they are professional adults who are coming to his house for parties and witnessing children, including his sisters, including these boys that have been placed by the legal system in his care, in his custody, and they're partying and seeing these kids using drugs and seeing the general debauchery.
And participating in it. One night at the party, the guys, his friends, the adults, were groping and making sort of offensive things to the boys. And I just went in and said, get your hands off them. They're kids. Like, I just went off my head. And I wrote about it in my diary. And then after that, I probably left because I think I became a nanny in Bellevue Hill after that. But then I kept in contact. I still remain quite close with his sister, but I did remember leaving and I just kept in contact with the young boy, the boyfriend.
Who had said to you that he's not gay and this is all really confusing, yeah.
Yeah, and he's like, well, would you like to be my girlfriend? I'm like, no, because you're a kid. And I'm probably not straight, but I didn't know that at the time. But, yeah, so I don't know what was going on in my head, but I know that his sister and I, we did end up leaving. And then she went off and got married. And
well, we know that one of his sisters, when Glenn became part of that setup, when Glenn was sent to live in that house with Simon Davies and his sisters by the courts and was sexually assaulted in that house, became a boyfriend, it was one of Simon's younger sisters who eventually made it stop, who went to Simon and said, enough, stop. We don't like what you're doing with these boys.
Mm.
Are you aware of that?
No.
That's part of Glenn's story.
That's good.
Yeah, it's great.
If you'd like to talk to someone about abuse that's taken place in your life, no matter how long ago it happened, your GP is always a good place to start. If that's not going to work for you, you can contact 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732 or via their website 1800respect.org.au. Or you can call Lifeline's 24-hour phone counselling service on 13 11 14.
Flexibility is great. That's why there's yoga. Flexibility for your insurance coverage is great too. That's why there's United Healthcare Insurance Plans. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, United Healthcare Insurance Plans offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. One of these plans may be right for you if you're, say, between jobs, coming off your parents' plan, turning a side hustle into a full hustle, or even missed open enrollment. Want more flexibility? Find out more about United Healthcare Insurance Plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. So start getting your best night's sleep in sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. And you can try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee, plus 15% off your first order with code BUTTERY. So head to bollandbranch.com today. Exclusions apply. See site for details.
So I kept in contact with one of the sisters and the other survivor, all through my adult life. So I got to see them. And we would talk about it. We were still talking about it in like this very, I don't know, abstract way, like not connecting the dots. But it was sad because, so you know how Simon's really into the whole privacy thing.
Well, I didn't really know that until you wrote that in your first message. And then when I went Googling, it was so interesting because all the newspaper articles refer to him as privacy expert and privacy advocate and all that.
So at that time, there was the privacy card. So Bob Hawke and Paul Keating really wanted to bring that out. So
the Australia card, yes.
Yeah, the Australia card.
Simon Davies was a big opponent of this card through which we could be more easily traced.
Yes, well, I mean, I think from a pedophile's point of view, you don't want that, do you? One of the gifts of Simon's boyfriend at the time, or, you know, not boyfriend, of his survivor, he was beautiful, creative, soft soul. And this is what makes me angry because Simon would get him to draw and he drew this cartoon, like satirical one-page cartoon. And it was the anti-Australia card and it had this, you know, like it was like a, I guess, political propaganda at the time. And it was a good drawing. And my friend, the survivor, was very proud of this and he got a lot of attention and it was in the newspaper.
So Simon used it in the campaign.
Yeah. And built him up. But then I don't know what happened. I think Simon left. He went to the UK and left this young man who's still young. I think he tried to go and do art school but failed. I feel for him. I think I don't want to speak too much about his story, but let's just say, like, a lot of the police did say to me, a lot of the survivors, yeah, they've struggled.
Simon Davies did, in fact, go overseas at some point. I mean, here he is. As I say, when we Google him, he comes up as international privacy expert. This is how newspapers were still talking about him when he was being extradited to Australia in 2021. Mm. They talk about him in quite glowing terms. So we have him here talking. There's photos of him talking all over the world as a public speaker about privacy issues. Do you know why he went overseas in the beginning? Was it to become an international privacy expert? Or do you think he thought, you know, shit was about to go down? Or
that's a good question because I often ask it. Also, when he was in Australia before he left, he set up the Australian Privacy Foundation and he has a paper on it. It's called The Loose Cannon, an overview of campaigns of opposition to national identity card proposals. And that was written from the visiting fellow. He's the director of Privacy International, visiting fellow, the London School of Economics, London, February 2004. And it's still on there. And it's interesting. And this is no shade on the people that are on the board now. I'm sure that I must admit that I'd love to know how they feel about this. I mean, I'm just dying of curiosity.
Yeah, absolutely. He's a convicted pedophile. And yeah, to think about, you know, this man setting up an organisation called the Australian Privacy Foundation is really sickening, isn't it? Of course you're a privacy advocate.
Well, it's interesting because, and I guess if you're looking at the sort of framework of privacy, which does work for people, like on their website, they have stuff like we need privacy for DV survivors and children. Yes, but there's this fine line, isn't it, around it. It's a good question when you ask me about why he left, because I don't know, because I'd lost. I obviously probably ran, like just was like, I got to get out of here. And I got into uni. I got into Sydney Uni.
Congratulations. Let's not throw that away. So you did know.
Yeah. I did it.
You were focused. You did know you were going to do it, irrespective of where things came from in your life. Congratulations.
Yeah,
well done.
Best time of my life. I didn't want to leave. And then I went off and I had a graduate certificate in public relations at UTS. So I did do it and I did have a career, and which is why I didn't think about him until I was working. And so I was working social justice and their communications and PR, and I saw his name and I go, what the fuck? And I'm going, what is he's advising Tony Blair? What the? So I'm just like, fuck this. Like, I was shocked. And then I started Googling him, obviously from my, you know, office in my PR office next to the CEO of some social change agency, going, holy shit, this is, but I never talked about it. You know, I didn't really get to terms with the abuse and sexual abuse and trauma until my 40s, but well, that's another story. But at that time in my 30s, I was very ambitious. Let's just say looking good and being ambitious probably got me to 40. I had a lot to prove. I had, because I was the first woman in my dad's side of the family to get a degree, and it was important to me. And actually, when I had to leave, but unfortunately, though, I had two lives. I had my working life, but then I had this other life, and it was very destructive. And it couldn't sustain.
Yeah, they collide eventually, don't they?
Yeah. I mean, I worked with Paul Keating, and I worked with Philip Adams and Bob Carr, and women, high, you know, very ambitious women and women that I really respected within the human rights. And my life's a complete, like, and you can't explain it.
Well, you come across also as, you know, not that way, but I know that's part of it.
Well, yeah, I'm 54 now.
Yeah, but a big part of it is, you know, not letting on that you're struggling, is, you know, learning how to mask what's really going on, and learning how to present to the rest of the world, looking around and seeing how everyone else is behaving, learning how to project that and not let anyone see what's really going on inside. That's probably a skill learned in dealing with your mum as well. Not letting anyone else know what's really going on inside, dealing with it in your own way, and then projecting what you think everyone else needs to see from you.
I agree. And it's very common for a lot of survivors. I mean, my story is not unique, but at the time it felt like I was the only person. And I will say that if you are at work and you notice someone, and rather than judging that person and going, they're unreliable, or you don't have to get involved. Workplaces have, you can just say, are you okay? Here's the number for the counselling service.
One good thing I've found in corporate Australia these days is that there's a lot of free counselling sessions. A lot of workplaces offer, even if it's two or three, just to open that door, like just take it. Just take it. If there is that poster on the pin board that you walk past every day and don't pay attention to, take it. Ring the number or whatever, call the extension. You know, go and have that one session if you are feeling crazy, and let it open the door to you to maybe get a referral to look further into why you're suddenly not coping.
Mm-hmm.
You have been coping at work always, and now suddenly you're just not.
Mm.
Maybe the worlds are colliding, like you talked about. Maybe you don't have to lose everything.
Yeah. When I thought, think back about it, I think, you could have just used your leave a bit better. And
but you don't know that at the time. You don't know it at the time. We're always saying we have to be more open about mental health. So let's not be embarrassed and hide it behind closed doors, whatever. And if people are judgmental about it, that's their problem, not ours.
I think it's hard in PR because you've got to show up all the time, and you're making other people look really good. So it was actually not the best career for me. So I was having a full umbrella, like I lost everything, like everything. My reputation, my career. This is PR, man. This is terrible. It was in Melbourne. So I had to go back to Sydney because I thought, okay, I better leave Melbourne. Having to stay in boarding houses and having very bad mental health issues and having to learn to deal with that. So it's been an odyssey. I'm out of it now. But I think in those days too, people didn't talk about it. And now, you didn't have language around trauma and child abuse. You didn't have the Royal Commission. The Royal Commission into institutionalized child abuse has changed everything. But when I was having my breakdown when I was 40, I mean, at that time, that's when my cousin was being caught out for what he did to his stepdaughter. And I had to do a report, like an affidavit. And so I had my whole dad's side of the family threaten me. And the last time I spoke to my dad in 2009, he said to me, oh, look, it's really normal for fathers to find their daughters attractive.
Oh, okay.
And I just went, okay, I wasn't like I am now. I was a different person. I was very weak. I was a real pleaser. People would have considered me being really flighty. I was unreliable. One minute I'm up, the next minute I'm hiding, and I was a mess. So I got back in contact with the other survivor and I had the diary, and I was trying to start my path of healing. And I sent him this and I said, here, and here are some phone numbers to call, because I was always trying to get him to, he never took up my advice. So, but I just couldn't help it. So I gave him this, and then sorry I'm off and on, but I had to kind of disconnect because I realized you can only tend your own garden. That was the best lesson I ever learned. And also with, now his younger sister who I was friends with, she'd occasionally contact me because she had a son and she'd talk about Simon, and it obviously worried her a lot. She had understandably very mixed feelings. She loved him, but obviously.
I can't imagine.
There's a Blue Knot Foundation. Blue Knot Foundation, they were great because they are for survivors of historical child abuse. And they're great. And I've been using them, since I was 40? And I still ring them occasionally. Very rare. It's getting rarer and rarer. But if I don't have any family. So sometimes if I get myself in a little thing, I ring Lifeline. Not because I'm suicidal, but I do need someone to go, hey, this happened, just to get me on a baseline.
Yeah.
Lifeline's good, but if you really want to train staff who understand the Royal Commission, who understand child molestation, who understand adults. So I gave my friend the survivor that, and I said, here's the number, ring it. Please don't contact me again.
Yeah.
And then I did the same with my friend, my other friends.
With Simon's sister.
It was really interesting. So I had sort of said farewell to the survivor and to the sister, because that was part of my, I can't do pedophiles anymore. I can't do trauma. I was 46 at the time. I was in Brisbane at that time, living there, and I had my own failed attempt with justice. Now, I had spoken to the school, the Department of Education Training, and they did apologise and they did speak to me, but they said, look, we just didn't even have any legislation until the 90s. Oh, okay. Well, that sucks. Hey, I should have taped it. And Jesus, been born a bit later, is that you need legislation to, protect kids. I think because my abuser was so attached to the police, even my mum said, we can't do anything, he's too well connected. She's probably right. And he was, again, like I said, he was well known and respected as a typical pedophile. But they did go, the cops did go and see my abuser. And he just obviously, I did it. Handcuffs. I'm going to give up my nice house and my family. And so they did say, look, we've been alerted to him. He's been warned. So that's about, unfortunately, your mother won't participate. None of your family will participate. Another kick in the, and I went, you know what? Okay, fine. That's that bit of my life's over now. I can't.
You've got to walk away. Yeah.
Yeah. I had to walk away. No point. So here I am, the context of this. I'm like, oh, good, I'm free of pedophiles. I can get on with my life. Knock, knock, knock. It's the police and it's Simon Davies' case. All of a sudden, and they came to Queensland. They were part of the task force. And that was hard. I was pretty angry, to be honest with you. I was not happy about it. I was very selfish about it because I was trying to get away and I just felt so trapped. But anyway, I looked and looked and looked for the diaries, and I must have lost them. And they wanted photos because I had photos as well of the party. It's such a shame. I used to take photos of everything. I had photos of Simon at the party with boys, but I must have lost them. I've moved 57 times. I'm 54 years old. So, we didn't have Facebook in the 80s and 90s. That was how I got involved in the case. And then they disappear. Off they go. Never hear anything until years later. I'm what is it, 2021, I'm 51 years old, and it's on the television, and he's been caught.
For 10 years, he was the target of a global manhunt, and tonight, an alleged pedophile is back in Australia behind bars. The 65-year-old man is accused of the sexual abuse of young homeless boys in the 1980s.
For more than a decade, police have searched the globe for this man. Simon Davies, a prominent privacy law expert, an activist for human rights, and according to police, an alleged pedophile.
So he went off. He had his career in the UK. He did the whole Tony Blair thing. He set this thing up. He then went off and I think he came out properly. He started living openly as a gay man. And he kept in contact with my friend, the survivor. And I remember writing to Simon and going, leave my friend alone. I'm not anti-gay or anything because I'm gay myself, but it's not right. Let him go. He got tipped off and he went into hiding. So that was kind of the end of my journey. And then I went off and it's been a lot better actually since then. And now I'm fine. But I have seen him walk through the gates. But I guess this is why we're talking. Why isn't there a podcast about this dude? Why isn't there more digging? Why the media is like, why are they still talking about him? Like he's this
privacy advocate.
It's weird. The thing is, if we weren't children to them, we were just lower beings. Because every time I said I'd been kicked out of home, it's like, well, what did you do? What did you do? It was always like what I had done. And it took me a long time. And every time someone would say that, I would just die inside. And it's like someone, like society just chipping away. And then I started reading my school reports. And then I started doing all my therapy. I'm like, oh, wait a minute. I'm actually great. I did nothing wrong. And I have to always remind myself, no, you're great. You're fantastic. You did nothing wrong. You just walked in to this. There's all these people that have been made invisible and he's still being promoted. So I just can't get over it. And I'm wondering why the media aren't picking it up. Because he has a board. There's a board at the Australian Privacy Foundation. Because part of me is like, I wonder how all these people, like these are like academics and doctors, and they must have all had thoughts about this, what had happened, and all the UK. Now, I'm not saying that they knew, but how do they feel about it, you know? I mean, it's just so weird. I know that he wasn't sort of popular in the kind of mainstream, like a Jimmy Savile type person, but I still think it warrants a deeper investigation because it just wasn't him either. And that's what the survivor said. And that was the last thing the survivor, because when they went to court, I did actually reach out to him just as the last time. And he did say, oh, yeah, like Simon's probably got a lot of information on a lot of people.
There are a lot of questions to be asked because it's obviously a fascinating story. We've heard from two people now and both of you have a lot of details from your own perspective, but you've opened up so many other questions. If anyone listening has any more information, please, we'd love to hear your story as well in relation to this story. We reached out to the Australian Privacy Foundation, the organisation founded by Simon Davies, which is still very much in existence, with some questions. Its website lists luminaries such as Father Frank Brennan, Julian Burnside, Anna Funder, Marie Kostakidis, Scott Ludlam, Gillian Triggs, Kerry O'Brien, and the Honourable Michael Kirby among its official supporters and advisers. You can read both emails in their entirety on our Facebook page, but I will take the liberty of summarising and paraphrasing the correspondence for you. Essentially, we asked why there's no disclosure of Davies' convictions for child sex crimes on the website, especially as the idea of personal privacy so often intersects in the public discourse with the rights of sex offenders. The representative for the Australian Privacy Fund replied that as Davies hasn't been an official member of the organisation for some time, they don't feel the need to comment publicly on his convictions. I mean, I personally wouldn't want to be a card-carrying supporter of an organisation founded by a convicted paedophile that's website still promoted his literature, but maybe that's just me. I also reached out to a number of those high-profile supporters seeking comment, but received no replies. Our guest, Marie, to whom we are indebted, has sent us a voice memo she wishes to include in the episode, and I can't think of a more fitting closer. So it's back to you, Marie.
So the police, once my case was, they closed it. It's now closed. They did say, though, the cops said, we'll go through the victims, New South Wales Department of Justice victims compensation claim. So interestingly enough, even though they didn't have enough to prosecute, I had enough evidence to get $10,000 in compensation plus counselling. And the counselling was amazing. I got 3 years free counselling, very, very useful. And to be honest with you, I think better than having to go through a court case. I think if I'd had my family behind me and I had, you know, that support, it would have been a good process. But to have to do that on my own, no. So I'm grateful for that. But the irony is it's just so ironic because on one hand, the New South Wales government are paying him to be a teacher. So he was teaching at that time, 2016, 2017. And then on the other hand, the government are giving me money and free counselling as a survivor of this man's sexual abuse. It's just a crazy world. The second thing that I wanted to say is about Simon, and I do wonder if Simon will ever listen to this or read Glenn's book or listen to anything that is said about him. He is a narcissist. I wouldn't put it past him. Look, he only got 10 years, and that's not a good enough sentence. That's terrible. However, I am happy that they put him in a, like last time I looked, he might have moved, but when he was taken to jail, he went to a new correctional facility, which isn't like the old school facilities. It's like open plan. So you don't get your own private cell. You're open plan. You're sharing with other inmates. It's like an open office, except it's where your bed is. And there's 60 cameras that watch the inmates. So he's been watched by all these cameras. And I think there's just some fantastic justice in that for this guy who was the leader of privacy, who used his campaign for privacy and building his career and his lovely life that none of his victims got to do, especially for my friend. My friend didn't get that opportunity, but I'm really, really glad and happy for my friend and for Glenn that Simon Davies is now being watched. And I hope that we don't stop watching him because I just don't think this is the end of the story. I'm hoping it's actually the beginning for the survivors.
If you need support after listening to this podcast, you can call Lifeline on 13 11 14 or contact 1-800-RESPECT on 1-800-737-732 or 1-800-RESPECT.org.au. Indigenous Australians can contact 13 Yarn on 13 92 76 or 13yarn.org.au. Thank you for downloading this episode of Australian True Crime. We'll be back next week.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Australian True Crime, the live show, is coming.